Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, or should I say good afternoon? This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. I have finally returned to South Carolina. This is where I live, and I'm still tired from the long trip from California. The jet lag has really beat me up. I've been planning to sit down and really work out a real detailed thing for big bands for this week. What started out on Comp Basie, but got tired up and tired and didn't go to some of the choir practices that I wanted to do. However, I'm just recuperating from that trip. But I did want to start something different other than piano players. And I came up with, even though I advertised big bands, I came up with Billie Holiday, who I had thought was a fantastic singer, and that didn't live a long life because of her style of living. But she was born on April the 7th, 1915, better known as the Billie Holiday until Eleanor Flagan, or Flagan, Flanagan. It's F-A-G-A-N. Her nickname was, of course, Lady Day, by her friend's music partner, such as Lester Young, who gave her the name Lady Day. Holiday had a semi-influence on jazz music and pop singing. Her vocal style, strongly inspired by jazz instrumentalists, pioneered a new way of manipulating phrases and tempos. She was known for her vocal delivery. Excuse me. And improvisational skills, which made up for her unlimited range and lack of formal music education. She didn't have any kind of formal training. After a turbulent childhood, Holiday began singing in nightclubs in Harlem, where she was heard by producer John Hammond, who commended her voice. She signed a record contract with Brunswick in 1935 in a collaboration with Teddy Wilson, yielded the hit What a Little Moonlight Can Do. And so we're going to spend a little time listening about, not listening to her sing, but finding out a lot about her life. To me, it was fantastic, but more importantly, we're going to hear about some of the things that I think that she was actually able to do. And so let's
hear. You are not lucky to know my favorite vocalist and America's number one song stylist, Miss Billie Holiday.
Hey there, baby, make up your mind, because I've been waiting such a long, long time.
This is one of Jazzy's greatest singers in her prime. But within 10 years of this performance, she was dead. Her body wrecked by drink and drugs. Partly thanks to the movie of her life, Lady Sings the Blues, she's come to be seen as a sad victim. A weak woman buffeted by forces beyond her control. Forces which eventually swept her away. But that's not the real Billie Holiday.
I'm going to get you.
I don't think she had a sad life. She was living her life the way she wanted to live.
She did as she pleased. She made a lot of money and she spent it all. She never took any nonsense from anybody. We don't want to be too patronizing, condemning her as a tragic figure.
Reefers, alcohol, heroin, men, women. She had a great appetite for sensation.
Both day and night. And night and day, you wanna see a lot of me.
Billie Holiday was born Eleanora Harris on the 7th of April, 1915. Her mother, Sadie, was an 18-year-old cleaner, and her father, a 16-year-old guitarist called Clarence Holiday. Her parents weren't married. They never even lived together. And Billie's independent spirit was forged fending for herself on the streets of Bolton.
She learned a lot of filthy language, and she would shout, "Suck my ass," at somebody in the street, and the chances are whoever it was would chase her down and punch her. But she'd do it anyway, because because she didn't want to take any nonsense from anybody.
One night when she was 11, Billy was raped by a neighbor. He was sentenced to 3 months, but Billy, the victim of the crime, was punished too. She was sent to the House of Good Shepherd for colored girls. Billy's street-smart ways didn't go down too well with the nuns. Once, she claimed, they forced her to spend the night with the body of a dead girl to teach her a lesson. In 1928, Billy and her mother moved to Harvard. They arrived to find the jazzy in full throat. Billy already loved to sing, and she would spend her evenings at rent parties. Private parties where people like Duke Ellington or Fats Waller would turn up and play, and the door money went towards the rent. But Sadie and Billy were paying their rent in a different way, working in a brothel. The two of them were arrested for prostitution. Billy, who was still barely 14, claimed to be 21. She was sent to Welfare Island, just off Manhattan. Here she spent 100 days in a workhouse for vagrant and dissipated adults. A change of career was called for.
There was a little gang of singers and dancers and comedians who would go from club to club performing for nothing. They do that all night long. Billy would go from table to table singing the same song and singing the chorus differently each time, teaching herself to improvise. This was priceless training.
The singers would go around the tables for their tips, but they were not allowed to take the money in their hands. They had to take their tips through another part of their anatomy, an intimate part of their anatomy. They all did it with Billy. She wouldn't do it.
She was singing in a club called Covans one night when young record producer John Hammond walked in.
He'd never heard an improvising singer like that. So Billy Holiday blew him away.
Hammond teamed her up with Benny Goodman, and 18-year-old Billy cut her first record.
You don't have to have a hanker to be a broker or a banker. No career just fits me. My mother's son-in-law.
She was now a recording artist, but she hadn't acquired too many airs and graces. Her friends described her character as don't care-ish.
We were coming down Broadway, and she reached in, pushed a cigarette lighter in the light cigarette. Lit the cigarette and threw the lighter out the window.
She used profanity with the deftness of an ice skater doing a figure eight.
Motherfucker, motherfucker, bitch, bitch.
Motherfucker.
But to her, it didn't sound so offensive because it sounded so natural. It was just the way she was.
This short Duke Ellington film was her next breakthrough. Billy played the role of a rejected woman. She complained she had to do so many takes of her scenes, she was black and blue by the end of the filming.
I'm able, I feel lost. I've got those lost memories. He didn't treat me fair. It's more than I can bear. I've got those lost memories. I've got those lost memories. Hanging back again.
Billy felt she needed someone to help her organize her burgeoning career. She turned to agent Joe Glazer, who was already representing Billy's idol, Louis Armstrong.
Glazer was a real tough guy, having come out of the Al Capone mob in Chicago.
Joe was a foul-mouthed, tough guy.
He scared me because he was so rough.
The first thing he wanted to do was lose weight and look after herself. Her weight was always up and down. But he always gave her money when she asked for it. He was very supportive.
Billy's profile was rising. She was appearing regularly at the Apollo, making more and more records in what was a unique singing style.
This year, I hope you see, don't be sweet to me.
She had enough courage to play with the music, and the beat is insistent. It says, follow me, I mean, hit me, be right on this beat. But it's sad just to hang behind it.
This is new romance.
It touches everybody who hears it, people who don't even know music. Who say, oh, Billy Holiday. Yeah.
She didn't jump around a lot. All she would do is stand in the spotlight, put her head back a little bit, and she would snap her fingers. And, you know, she had you in the palm of her hand.
In 1937, Billy's father, Clarence, died. He'd had pneumonia, but hadn't been able to find a hospital that would take blacks. Billy, although she had never seen that much of her father, was distraught. Her way of dealing with the grief was to throw herself into her work. She decided to go on tour with the Count Basie Band. The physical discomfort of being on the road didn't bother her too much. She spent most of her time playing dice at the back of the bus and feeding the rest of the band. Sometimes they had to borrow money back just so they could eat. But this was the 30s. And for a black band, life often proved demeaning as well as uncomfortable.
You could not stay in a hotel. You'd stay with black families in that town. Couldn't eat where everybody else ate. You'd eat where the black folks ate, or in the back of the restaurant, and could never go to the bathrooms that white people went to. In some ways, there weren't even outhouses for black people. It was degrading.
She played a gig in Detroit where the management demanded that she black up, put on dark makeup. Because she was too light for the band. Everybody else in the band was darker. Foolish insult.
One compensation for the hardships was the presence in the band of sax player Lester Young.
That relationship is one of the most beautiful parts of her whole life story. They were such close friends. They were soulmates. They weren't even lovers, according to their contemporaries. They just delighted in each other's company.
My man, that's my man.
He'd call anybody lady of any gender, and he dubbed her Lady Day. They were just meant for each other musically. They caressed each other for the microphone.
The adorer is clear in every note.
Myself and I are all in love with you. We all think you're wonderful.
After touring with Count Basie, Billy went on the road with Artie Shaw and his all-white band. The racism she'd experienced with the black band was now thrown into even sharper focus.
They had a gig in New York, ironically enough, at the Hotel Lincoln, and she was told that she had to take the freight elevator. As a black person, she couldn't ride in the regular elevator, presumably because it would upset the other guests in the hotel. And she was so irked by this that she quit the band.
Billy was back in New York at just the right time. A few weeks later, she was invited to be the opening attraction at a radical new nightclub.
Cafe Society was quite an extraordinary place. It was the first and only integrated nightclub in New York. It was started by a left-wing guy named Barney Josephson, a former shoe salesman,
okay, fellas,
who was determined that blacks and whites should have a place where they could fraternize together, watch entertainment together, where the racial barriers that existed really in the rest of the country and even in much of New York City would no longer exist.
At Cafe Society, Billy was approached by Abel Mirapol, a communist poet. He had a song he wondered if she might be interested in performing. It was a song about lynchings.
The
swinging in the stars of breeze.
Moon chains had been a national scandal for many years, and they were still very much a part of the black consciousness in America. Everybody knew somebody who'd been lynched, or knew somebody in whose family there had been a lynching. She was a quintessentially political person with a highly developed race consciousness and a sense of injustice, and she developed this intensely personal relationship with the song.
In the sudden smell of burning flesh.
As I think of it now, I can feel that I'm kind of changing inside. I don't want to think about it. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but it was, in a way, it was a revolting experience to listen to Billy tearing your heart out.
For the tree to drop.
People would get indignant, and every once in a while, people would get abusive. There was one instance where a man said, "Billy, I want to show you some real strange fruit." And he showed her an obscene picture that he'd drawn on a napkin. And she picked up a chair and hit him over the head with it.
Here is a strange.
The way that she put so much heart and soul into it, you know, made it inimitable.
In 1941, she married Jimmy Monroe, a small-time wheeler dealer who introduced Billy to opium, or hop smoking. The relationship was short-lived, partly thanks to Jimmy's rolling eye, which prompted her song, Don't Explain.
Chip there, lipstick, don't explain.
But sexually, Billy was at least as freewheeling as Jimmy.
I can remember him saying to me, if Jimmy accuses me of having an affair with somebody, I'm going to do it.
Orson Welles was one lover, but Billy was casting her net wider than men.
I was thinking about 15 when I was saying to my father that Billy Holiday could really sing a love song. And he said, she sure can. He said, but if you think she can sing a love song to a man, you should certainly see her singing one to a woman.
Billy had lady friends and she had men friends. You know, I think she was like both sexes. I don't think she had any preference, really.
Her female lovers probably included wealthy heiress Louise Crane and actress Tallulah Bankhead.
I remember one time this woman kept shouting at Billy, saying, "I understand you know Tallulah Bankhead." Well, after about the third time, Billy looked at her and said, "You're had her
in the Dunbar Hotel, where the black performers stayed on Central Avenue in Los Angeles, which is where I grew up. They had these peepholes in the bedrooms. And so one guy told me when he was working there, she's going to be there with another woman. I don't believe that." And he went and said, "Oh, yeah, right there." You know, so he said he saw her in there, yeah, having fun. The scissors, as they used to call it.
When I learned that Billie Holiday had had partners of both sexes, I was delighted because I like to think that there were women who were equally as savvy, equally as catty, and equally as voluptuous, and equally as loving, and as fierce as Billie Holiday, and that they had a wonderful time.
One guy said he walked in on her and two other women one time. But you never know, that could be an exaggeration. But it could also be true.
Her next male partner was trumpeter Joe Guy. Who got who involved is unclear, but before long they were both addicted to heroin.
But I'm feeling so sad. I long to try something I've never had.
Sadie was an addictive personality, no doubt. And anything that was out there, she was going to try it.
Love a man, oh well, can you be?
your guy became her dealer as well as her lover. As her addiction took hold, she would turn up later and later for her shows. If her supply didn't arrive, there'd be other problems.
We couldn't get out of dressing room the whole night. So they had people came in and went on for her in her place, but she said she couldn't do it. So she just stayed there waiting to be melody come out.
The night is cold and I'm so all alone. I give my soul just to call you my own.
This holiday, my dressing room had a wad of Kleenex, which concealed a double-edged razor blade. And she just walked up to this musician, went and sliced his shirt into ribbons and made one little drop of blood off his chest into it, walked silently into a dressing room, and that was that. Somebody had made a delivery and had cut it in half or something like that, and she wasn't having any. I mean, it's the kind of thing that could make you wet between the knees.
She was making $1,000 a week, and that in the 40s was a lot of money. And she was spending it all on drugs. And it was just pathetic. I mean, she didn't have a nightgown to sleep in. She slept in old evening gowns. She had a lot of those. But it really was an awful thing to realize here is this really lovely lady who has got all of this talent, and it's just oozing away.
In 1946, she was offered a part in a movie. As a black woman, her casting as a maid was predictable.
Nobody believes you miss New Orleans when that's where you left your heart.
Andy, didn't I tell you not to let me catch you at that piano again?
I'm sorry, ma'am. If I'd have heard you coming, I wouldn't have let you catch me.
Andy, you're incorrigible.
The film, though, did give her the chance to appear with her hero, Louis Armstrong.
When the moon's tired of dreaming, stars and dreaming, and that's our nothing at all. If you're kind of lonely and all by your own way, then nothing but the blues are brewing. The blues are brewing.
Through the shooting, Joe Guy traveled to Hollywood to keep her supplied with heroin, until her agent, Joe Glazer, had him banned from the set. When she got back to New York, Billy and her dog, Mister, had an unwelcome visitor.
Charlie Parker was scratching on her door, and Parker was notorious for hitting on people for money or drugs. She had bought some rock cocaine, which she was pulverizing in her room. And Charlie Parker's at the door, and she goes, she can't let him in. And she puts all the pediment under the bed, and he busts his way in. And as she's denying that she has access to anything, the dog comes out from under the bed, stiff from snorting cocaine.
Glazer decided he had to tackle Billy's addiction. He persuaded her to take him to a New York hospital to be weaned off.
She stayed there 2-4 weeks, supposedly, but I understand later that the nurse was getting her drugs.
Soon afterwards, Billy was performing in Philadelphia. After the last show, pianist Bobby Tucker was collecting her things from the hotel when the police arrived.
They had the drawers, turn them over underneath the sink, in the bathroom, the toilet up top, and they found this stocking, a lady stocking with drugs in it. And he said, So they took us down.
Bobby Tucker was quickly released, but Billy was charged with possession of heroin. On Joe Glazer's advice, she declined legal representation.
The whole business of the way she was convicted is tragic because she didn't know what she was doing. And Glazer let her down completely.
I think he felt at the time that this might be good for her, strange as that may sound, but that this would be a way that she could finally, you know, kick the drug addiction.
Billie Holiday had been expecting to be sent to a hospital. Instead, she was sentenced to a year and a day in a women's prison in Alderson, Virginia. She refused to sing a note all the time she was there. She was eventually released on parole, on condition she stayed with Bobby Tucker and his mother in New Jersey. When she came out, she'd had nothing stronger than a cigarette for 9 months.
Her train from Morrison stopped in Washington. She got off and scored. And I met her in New York. And when she got off the train, she gave me a big hug, and I could see, she said, oh, lady, she's high in her car. I said, how could you? There's no hope then. She said, no, I guess not.
Her conviction meant she lost a cabaret card. Without one, singers couldn't appear anywhere in New York where alcohol was served. Unable to perform in nightclubs, a comeback concert was organized in Carnegie Hall. Billy was convinced no one would show up.
It was completely sold out to such a degree that there were seats on stage, which was, I think, the first time that had been done in Carnegie Hall, and I put my bass over the crowd. Billy was nervous, so much so that when she was trying to pin her gardenia in my hair, she accidentally stuck the pin in too far, and her head started to bleed.
And it bled like crazy. And but she was wearing a black gown, I don't know anyway. So I said, cancel the concert. She can't make it. She said, I'll be all right. And she performed. The audience couldn't see the blood stains on her dress because it was black. But I think she had it because after being treated like a pile of crap, you know, and to come out and see the many people, they truly cared.
This triumphant return didn't solve Billy's problem of not being able to perform in the clubs, which were her natural terrain. But then she met John Levy, part owner of Club Emily on 52nd Street.
He was really a pimp and a hustler, that's what we called him in those days.
Levy told Billy he could fix it for her to get a cabaret card. Before long, they were lovers, and Levy became her unofficial manager, too.
I sometimes go down to get her to do a show. And she's on the floor, and he's kicking her.
I never, ever hit her in the face or anything where it was visible when she went on stage. He didn't want her to not be able to work. But he beat her around her ribs. And I recall one time in Philadelphia, Bobby and I had to go and get large tape bandages and bandage up her ribs so she would be able to stand up while she sang.
It's a beast. I can't think of a nice word to say about him.
For whatever reason, Billy chose to take physical abuse from her male partners. She would sometimes even encourage it. But she was more than capable of sticking up for herself when she wanted to.
She would fight like a man, if necessary. Even when it wasn't necessary, she would. She was at the bar drinking her regular drink, which was white cream to mint and glossy. But in a double or triple shot glass, you know. And they're very heavy. And this seaman said to the bartender, he says, since when do you start serving nigger bitches at the bar? And she took the glass and turned it around, and she beat the crap out of him. Beat him out of her face, and he sued her for a lot of money.
Two white men who were very culturally ignorant put out their cigarettes on her fur coat. And she apparently said, well, you know, let's go outside. And she took off her fur coat and she proceeded to beat them both, you know, wonderfully well. So that's the lady. You know, that's the lady day. I mean, if you're going to be a lady with fists, you know, as well as, you know, your lipstick and your high heels.
In San Francisco, the law again caught up with Billie Holiday. She and John Levy were arrested for possession of opium.
this time, lady was a little smarter and booked herself into an institution where she could have as much to drink as she liked, but was drug-free for quite a while, so that she was examined before she went to court and pronounced not to have any drugs in her system at all. And the whole thing collapsed. She got away with it.
No one could have missed the defiant message of Billy's very mixed record.
If I should take a notion to jump into the ocean, ain't nobody's business if I do.
There were other musicians tossing and moving around, and this man walked up. And people were saying, hey, you're lying, baby, you know, how are you? And he came up to me and he spat. Spat at me.
This was the new man in Billie Holiday's life, Louis McKay.
Louis D.K., that was the phrase that my mother used about him.
Bad guys were like magnets for her. If there were 100 guys in a room and one of them was an asshole, she'd go right to that guy.
Well, I love you. I don't know why I should. He isn't sure. He beats me too. What can I do? Oh, my man, I love him so. He'll never know. All my life is just despair. But I don't care.
She had a strong masochistic streak. And she wanted guys who would hurt her, both physically and emotionally.
She needed that particular kind of dangerous fellow who had the drag to bribe the cops, deal with the narcs, and so on. A wimp like me would have been no protection at all to her. I couldn't handle this kind of stuff, you know?
In 1954, Billy left the U.S. for the first time to tour Europe. The audiences were hugely enthusiastic. Some of the hotels she stayed in, less so.
After the departure of Mrs. Billie Holiday of today, we discovered that in her room a big destroyance had taken place. Burning cigarettes had made marks in the toilet table, the writing table, and the carpet in a way.
In Paris, she went for a drink with her young friend, Annie Ross.
She was drinking something like brandy with a pen of float or something really weird. Well, what are you going to do? You follow your idol. I did too. And I fell on my face. Because all down the Champs-Élysées, swinging back drinks. And then she said, oh, there's a jewelry store. Let's go in there. We went into this little jewelry shop, and the man was bringing out trays of gold charms or key rings or whatever. And once in a while, he'd go back into the other room to get some more stuff and bring it out. And lady looked through all these things, and she said, no, I don't see anything I think my daddy would like. So we walked out, and when we got about a block down the street, she dug into her pockets and brought out all this jewelry.
I'm a star of tonight. I don't know if it's cloudy or bright. But I only have eyes for you, dear. So maybe millions of people go by. But I only have eyes for you.
This appearance on French television was something of a rarity. Back in the U.S., Billie had never become a familiar face on TV. Her well-publicized drug habit had scared off the networks, and more particularly their sponsors. Unlike many of her contemporaries, she was never asked to appear in Ed Sullivan's top-rated variety show.
I said, you should be on the Selvin Show. And she said to me, baby, that motherfucker used to smoke hop with me uptown. He wouldn't want my black ass anywhere near his show.
In an attempt to generate more publicity and more cash, Louis McKay came up with the idea of Billy's autobiography. She asked her friend, journalist William Duffy, to write it with her. Once the manuscript was delivered, the publisher started to get nervous.
The lawyers focused on the fact that she used the word bitch too much in the book. And well, to her, a bitch was as non-inflammatory a word as person. It meant the adjective, a cute bitch, a little bitch, a sweet bitch, and so on. So how they listened, and she wrote in her own hand, change bitch to whore.
Tallulah Bankhead, anxious about what revelations the book might contain, denied even knowing Billie Holiday.
She threatened Doubleday and said, Miss Holiday is a great artist, but unfortunately we've never met. Well, that raised the whole question of everybody. Any white person, male or female, mentioned favorably meant she was having an affair with them. If she mentioned unfavorably, she was lying about them. She was libeling them, and it might be actionable. So it was months or years before I could even look at the book, because it merely says what was possible in 1955 for a black woman with a police record to publish.
But even before the book came out, Billy got some less welcome publicity. She was arrested for the third time for drug possession, this time for heroin and cocaine. She and McKay had been taking speedballs in a Philadelphia hotel room.
She had a pill. I've gone over this so many times in my mind. Did I dream it? Did I make it up? You know? But she had one little pill. She said, before I go to jail again, I'll take this. Ugh.
The pill wasn't needed. Billy and McKay were put on probation for 12 months. But in the meantime, McKay had persuaded Billy to marry him so he couldn't be forced to testify against her in court. He'd already been buying property with her money and putting it in his own name. Now he was her husband, too. But this new marriage wasn't about to satisfy a long, frustrated need.
I think Billy had a very strong mothering kind of nature. I think she regretted that she didn't have a child.
We were in a Chinese restaurant. She was having her favorite roast duck, and there was a tub of mustard. It must have been for me. She looked at, gave it a jaundiced eye, and she said, take back that stuff. The smell of mustard does something to me. And I must have probed it a little bit. And she came up with a story that she had once sat in a tub of mustard water, which was an inexpensive way to have an abortion. She had, the nun said that God will punish you. And she said, they did too. All I ever wanted was that baby. All I ever wanted was that baby.
These unfulfilled maternal feelings stayed strong throughout her life, as her godchildren discovered.
Holiday would nurse me on her breast. She would suckle me, even though she didn't have any milk. She really had tried to clean up and not use any drugs, not use any heroin, but to compensate, she really had to smoke quite an amount of marijuana. And in America, it's called contact high, but the smoke was wafting around, and I was certainly, since there was no milk for me to ingest, I was certainly inhaling a lot. And my mom always describes that I was a very happy, hungry baby that slept a lot.
You can't see no. There we go.
There is a tape where she's rehearsing, and then I'm running around, and she's trying to keep me occupied, and I start banging keys. She was there every day, and she wanted to hold me and breastfeed me and talk shit with me and sing to me, and I really felt I had like two moms, you know.
Yeah, she's got it, no.
Mm-hmm.
2007, she was finally invited to appear on Peak Time TV on a CBS special which would reunite her with soulmate Lester Young.
Dan, Studio 58 and the Sound of Jazz. Billie Holiday is one of a handful of really great jazz singers. Playing with her here today are some of the musicians who accompanied her back in the 30s and some of the greatest jazz records ever made.
Two kinds of blues, the blues. It's sort of a mixed up thing, you just have to feel it. Anything that I do sing, it's part of my life.
My man don't love me. He treats me awful.
She sang Fine and Mellow, which was one of the few blues she ever sang, and she wrote the lyrics.
He don't love me. It treats me out of me. He's the lowest man that I've ever seen.
Lester was at that point in time really not well, and that one chorus that he plays says a lot, but that was about all he could do.
He played one of the purest blues choruses I've ever heard. She's giving a nod and a half smile, and their eyes met. And you could imagine, even if you didn't know anything about the background, that they were reliving something, something they really enjoyed thinking about in the past and sort of regretting that it wasn't there. And in the control room, we all had tears in our eyes. And I figured at the time, we ought to cut the show there because we're not going to top it.
But when he starts and he loves me, he is so fine.
But Billy was struggling with another deeper dependency, and the effects on her body and her voice were becoming more and more difficult to ignore.
She came to rely more and more on alcohol to get her through periods when she was not using drugs heavily. On the other hand, when she was heavily addicted, she would be using so much that she'd run out of places to inject herself. And there are stories about between the toes and so forth and other even more intimate places.
Louis McKay found her increasingly impossible to handle.
She found out something about him that he had done, and I remember she said she took his head and put it down the toilet or something like that for a few minutes, and she chuckled away at it, you know. I think she just laughed at it because I don't think she imagined that she could do something like that. It's just kind of weird, funny. I said, you put it in the toilet? And she said, I didn't put it in there just for a minute.
He packed his bags and moved to California. She moved into a small one-bedroom flat.
She asked me to her birthday party, and I went, and it was sweet, but it was bittersweet, because she was evidently knowing me. You would have thought that a person of her stature would have had people dying to be with her, but she was going through a bad period, and like she said, they don't come around no more.
One by one, her record companies had dropped her. But she managed to persuade arranger Ray Ellis to work on a new album with her.
We had one meeting where we picked all the titles. And then she was supposed to realize, okay, well, let's get together and make sure the two. She never showed up for anything.
So I walked and listened to fans. And I jazz, I listen to fast, and I'm reckless, it's true, but what else can you do? That's the end of a love affair, I know it, that's the end of a love affair, I know it.
Now, please shine as much light as you can and loud as you can. I don't know the tune.
Really? Shining all the way up. I've never needed to have any cues or anything put up for her to remember a lyric. But on this particular session, she lost it. She couldn't remember the lyrics.
She had a big glass that looked like water, but it was straight gin. And after a little taste, I was real thirsty. And I said, hey, can I say, yeah, baby, go ahead. You know, and I took this like it was water. Boy, that, what a surprise that was. So by the end of the session, she was really, whoa, 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 you know, getting out. Like, yeah, do it fast.
I can't hear the bad
at all. Was a pathetic figure on that session, and I hate to even think about it anymore because that's not the way you'd want to see somebody who you had worked with and really knew their talents and their abilities and everything, to see them go down like that. It was a pitiful situation.
And the kings and queens are always
the best. But not everyone agrees this was a singer in decline.
Many jerks who have this idea that the best Billy Holiday was the happy-go-lucky 1930s Billy Holiday, but I think the Billy Holiday of later actually was the greatest singer.
Lady of the Fountain was her favorite record. It's my favorite album because there's a whole life in that voice.
Maya Angelou, then a young singer, phoned Billie Holiday and her audience one night.
I said, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know that a great person is in the audience. And Miss Billie Holiday, the people popped up and applauded and applauded. And they sat down. She didn't recognize their applause or anything. She just sat there with a dog. And then I began to sing, and I sang an old blues, and my voice is nothing like hers, but it was,
baby, please don't go, baby, please don't go, baby, please don't go back to New Orleans, they'll feed you rice and beans. Worst you ever seen. Baby, please don't go.
I sang one verse and she screamed, shut that bee up. Shut up. You remind me of my mother. Shut up. And she got up and ran into the toilet. So I left the stage and went in. She said, did you see all those rifles to stand up when you mentioned my name? I said, yes. She said, you know why? I said, yes, I know why. Why? What do you think? She said, they wanted to see a black woman who'd been in trouble for drugs. That's the only reason they look at me. That's sad.
In early 1959, she came to London to perform on a TV show called Chelsea at Night.
I was vacuuming in my flat in Belfast Park, I remember that. And the phone rang, and I didn't know, and she said, Heather, are you? I'm at the airport. I said, Billy? And she said, yes.
I love you. Hulk.
I was with her in the dressing room all the time. I couldn't go out. She wouldn't let me do anything. I would say then there was a certain paranoia there of not trusting. I was in the loo and heard footsteps and I heard someone say, where are you? What? And I said, I'm in the loo. And then suddenly I saw hands and things at the bottom and I'm not good. You know, sort of, I thought, what is she doing? She said, well, what are you doing? I said, I'm in the loo. And she said, well, okay, I'll wait. I thought she wanted to go. But no, she just waited, and then we walked back into the green room, and I thought, oh, my. Oh, my.
It's going to be like dying.
But she was alone. Very much alone.
When he calls me, but when he comes, I know I'll have to go.
She returned to the States to discover that Lester Young had died. It was a shattering blow for her.
At his funeral, Billy had obviously requested she wanted to sing and was not allowed to do that. I became aware of this just when there was a slight commotion, and suddenly I heard Billy's voice. She was crying, and she was saying, "They won't let me sing. Those motherfuckers won't let me sing. They won't let me sing." And we got her outside, and there was a bar next door. So we took her to the bar and got her drink, and she calmed down a little bit, but not very much. It obviously hurt her very deeply.
A few weeks later, completely emaciated, she collapsed. One hospital refused to take her, and she was eventually admitted to the Metropolitan Hospital, suffering from liver failure.
My first sight of her was frightening because the thing I remember is the hollows here. I know what I mean. It was skeletal.
Her condition improved slightly, but then a few days later, a nurse found some white powder in her room, and Billie Holiday was arrested once again for possession. She was threatened with being immediately imprisoned unless she gave the police the name of her supplier.
It was strange because as sick as she was, her attitude towards this whole thing was, again, these were Keystone cops, you know, and the people who were shocked was the attorney and me. Ooh. And this was just more of the same for her. She said, what do they think of next, you know?
The district attorney was eventually persuaded to postpone the case until Billy was well enough to appear. But that was looking less and less likely prospect as her condition worsened. In the meantime, her estranged husband had flown in.
And I saw who's in her room but Louis McKay. And he had a Bible open in his hands. And she seemed to be moribund. And he was doing the Protestant ritual. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And he's making me to lie down in green pastures. So it scared me to death because I thought, oh my God, it's too late. And eventually he slammed the Bible shut and tiptoed down the hall. So I waited for a minute and tiptoed into the room. And at that point, Billy opened one eye. I said, "Is he gone?" And I said, "I think so." And she sat up in bed and said, "You know, I always been a religious bitch. But if that dirty motherfucker believes in God, I'm thinking it over." And of course, you know, talk about black humor, talk about deathbed humor.
Billy was terrified of dying penniless. Thanks to Louis McKay, this was a distinct possibility. But Bill Duffy managed to get an article about her addiction commissioned by Confidential magazine and brought her $750 in cash.
She rolled the 50s up tight, 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 and then she slid them up between her knees into the office. And it was like a green transfusion. And the miracle, or whatever, is that she was able to have a safety deposit to the very end.
That end came on the 17th of July, 1959.
It was after midnight, and I was in this little anteroom, and I remember her nurse came to the door and she said, "Are you Bill? Is your name Bill?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "This is for you." And she had a towel, and these were all the $50 bills, you know. So that was the signal.
she was 44.
She looked as if she had been torn from life violently, and she looked, you know, it was disturbing to see her there.
I made a series of boxes that I drew things and wrote little notes to her in. I love you. I miss you. I will see you. I drew hearts and phones and little animals and things, and it was buried in her casket with her.
Record she made has a wonderful song with a title to say that is almost indescribable.
Don't worry about me. I'll get along.
Don't worry about me. I'll get along somehow.
Forget about me.
Well, even now, I feel moved by the fact that it's just doing so well. Jesus Christ, I'm going to cry.
Let's say that our lips show is over and so the story.
I don't think she's the kind of person for whom she feels sorry, really, because she always was able to express herself artistically. A lot of people who become drug addicts are alcoholics, that's all they are.
She was living her life the way she wanted to live it. I don't think it was a case of somebody saying, well, I don't want to do this, but somebody's making me do this and I have to do this. I don't think that was the case at all. I think Billie did everything she did because she was Billie Holiday, and that's it.
I don't know how long ago she died, but here I am, still listening to her music, still being lifted up. So many people around the world, you know, get up and get through the day, because Lady Day is Lady Day, and she's singing.
Please don't talk about me.
There's no music in this life, and we can just swing continues, because we remember the genius of Sean Parker.
If you can't say anything,
you've been listening to Getting It Done by Dr. Walter Dean, and the show that we featured today was the great legendary jazz singer Billie Holiday. You heard all the excerpts and various statements concerning her career. And I think that she did it the way she wanted to do it. In any event, next week we plan on doing some big bands and starting off with Count Basie on to Stan Kenton. I'm looking forward to hearing from those of you who are writing me and telling me about the show on the sound. And in any event, have a good weekend or the rest of the weekend and a good time until I hear and see the great music signs of things to come. Once again, this is Dr. Walter Dean, and the show was Getting It Done featuring Billie Holiday.